Hi, I'm Helen.
And I'm Jess.
Welcome to another episode of Dose of Pharma. Today, we're joined by Jay, who is a third-year PhD student specializing in neurodegenerative diseases at Monash University. And we'll be discussing mental health and brain disorders and what it's like to conduct research in this area. So to begin with, Jay, would you be able to tell us a bit about yourself?
Yeah, thanks for the invite. And yeah, always happy to talk about my interest in neuroscience and my project. I'm very passionate about it. So I'm a third year PhD student at the Monash Institute of Pharmaceutical Sciences. I currently work under the supervision of Associate Professor Joseph Michelazzo and Dr. Jennifer Short. And yeah, my project is focusing on neurodegenerative diseases. What brought me to MIPS. I didn't do my undergraduate degree in pharmaceutical sciences at all. So I do have a neuroscience background, but I thought, when I finally decided, right, I'm going to do my PhD, I decided to come to MIPS because I think it's a really good transitional zone for clinical research when coming from a fundamental background. So it was kind of like a strategic move to kind of go into the space of clinical research as well. So
it sounds like a pretty smart move to make that shift. What initially interested you in researching treatments for brain disorders?
Yeah, so initially I was interested in neuroscience because in high school we did this amazing human biology unit. It was only over 2 weeks, and we got to explore the structure, the anatomy, and the physiology of the human brain at the very basic level. And obviously, I was sold then by the biology teacher. And my fascination of the brain actually stemmed from it literally makes us who we are. It makes us think, make us remember, all our personalities kind of, stem from different structures within our brain. So again, this is what sparked an interest in neuroscience. And then I guess in terms of researching, going from a fundamental kind of basic science of what is the normal function of the brain, what is occurring in a healthy individual, I really wanted to see or wanted to fix a problem because, neuroscience, from looking at it from a fundamental perspective to a treatment perspective, it was much more rewarding personally that you're trying to, I guess, understand a problem that exists. And you're trying to fix that problem. And so that's what I guess initially interested me into researching, treatments in mental health and brain disorders. But at the same time, coincidentally, my grandma also had a neurological disorder, Alzheimer's disease. And this was during, the time where I had started my master's degree in neuroendocrinology. And so this interest really became a passion because I saw, that so little could be done for, my grandma and all of the people that suffer from neurological disorders. So I guess, this interest really did become a passion. And not all scientists go into a disease state because they've had family members in that disease state. But for me, it really did become, it was an interest to start with, but it really became a passion because I saw that there was so much room for improvement, enhancing or improving the quality of life for patients that are suffering from such a debilitating disease.
Yeah, I think it's hard not to be at least a little bit fascinated by the brain. Like you said, it controls so much of who we are and what we do. And to have that Absolutely. Personal connection, it definitely drives it a lot more. But it's devastating how little we can do in that area.
Yeah, absolutely.
As you said, there's so little things that could be done to help with these patients. And so as you dig deeper into this area, what do you think are some major challenges that contribute to the difficulty of treating mental health or brain disorders?
Yeah, I guess it's a question for all neuroscientists and, you know, anyone looking at neurological disorders. The brain is such an important and actually quite delicate organ. And these very delicate kind of central nervous system cells need to be maintained in this really strictly controlled environment. Otherwise, you know, you learn about homeostasis, it becomes outside of that homeostatic environment. And so it needs to be strictly maintained. I think that's one of the major challenges. But anatomically, the brain is actually in a very difficult location to be able to get access to various types of treatments. If you want to get into the brain invasively, you have to, you know, literally drill through the skull, right? And that's quite invasive. Whereas if you're taking drugs, there's a structure, or not a structure, a thing that my project directly looks at is the blood-brain barrier that protects your brain from anything that is potentially toxic that is circulating in the systemic circulation. And so a major challenge for pharmaceutical scientists and, you know, drug discovery is that, you know, this blood-brain barrier actually protects your brain from anything entering into it too easily. And that's great in terms of protection, but again, it becomes a major challenge when trying to develop and discover drugs to have targets within the brain. And I think that is a major challenge, yeah, in terms of permeability of drugs, accessibility, as well as, yeah, the specific targets within the brain. It's really hard to access because it's anatomically kind of positioned that way.
Yeah. Would you be able to like expand a bit more about like what your focus is in neuroscience, and then how does that research address like these difficulties?
Yeah. So my project specifically focuses on these various, they're called efflux transporters that are expressed at the blood-brain barrier. So the barrier between the brain and the blood. And these efflux transporters are responsible for, I guess, keeping, you know, any kind of toxic molecules out from the brain. And in Alzheimer's disease and quite a lot of other neurological disorders, it's not just limited to Alzheimer's disease. There is a change in the expression of these specific proteins or these key efflux pumps that pump out, I guess, toxic molecules that are circulating in the systemic circulation, preventing their, you know, passage through to the brain. But also in Alzheimer's disease, they pump out a toxic molecule or a toxic peptide that builds up and accumulates in the brain of people with Alzheimer's. It's called amyloid beta. And so the specific protein that I'm looking at is called ABCB1, which is a ATP binding cassette superfamily transporter. And it's quite often referred to as P-glycoprotein. You know, various members of the audience may have heard about P-glycoprotein in the aspect of like cancer as well. It's applicable in cancer because there is an overexpression of this P-glycoprotein in tumor cells that causes this multi-drug resistance. And so thus these tumors become resistant to any kind of chemotherapy. But at the blood-brain barrier, they have this absolutely key role to protect the brain and pump out the toxic molecules that are accumulating in the brain of people with Alzheimer's. And so if you imagine that these protein gets kind of almost wiped out or diminished in terms of the numbers that are available, it's going to lead to an accumulation of this toxic peptide in the brain. And so I'm actually quite excited about like the project and its direction, because we're seeing some really promising ground in being able to restore this efflux transporter at the BBB. So I was lucky enough to get a plethora of skill sets through my PhD project. I started with cell lines looking at human brain endothelial cells. So those are the cells that express this, you know, efflux transporter at the BBB. And we were able to show using a compound known as copper ATSM that is able to restore these efflux transporters at the brain. And we've actually, I guess, translated that into an in vivo model, and it's showing the same response. So, yeah. So watch this space. And in terms of the compound that I'm currently using, it was So I collaborate with a number of people down at the University of Melbourne at the Florey Institute of Neuroscience and Mental Health, as well as Bio21. So it's a real collaborative, like team approach. And what the compound actually is a compound that is neuroprotective. It's been increasingly shown to be neuroprotective, not just for Alzheimer's disease, but also motor neuron disease. So they're in phase two clinical trials for motor neuron disease with the compound that I'm currently using, as well as Parkinson's disease. They're seeing some motor improvement with this compound. So I'm applying it into the Alzheimer's disease field because it has these anti-inflammatory, antioxidative properties, as well as for what we're finding is it's able to restore some proteins that are diminished in these neurological disorders. So yeah, quite promising.
Well, that sounds very interesting because I'm doing this unit about pharmacokinetics and pharmacodynamics, and also a bit about like drug discovery and formulations. And I also had like a short period of time where I studied with Professor Joe. So he was talking all about the transporters and efflux, and now it sounds very interesting to see how all those theory could be potentially applied into real life to solve a problem, and to see like a bigger picture of it. And also like to make connections with other units as well. So like to connect with pharmacology and biology. Yeah, so since you're a PhD student and you also do teaching, which means that you interact with many students. So what do you think are the areas of neuroscience that students could potentially be interested in and to consider a career in this field?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I've had a long discussion with Jess actually on you know my I guess outlook on the future of medicine. And what I think is really interesting now is that we currently live in a era called the biorevolution. So we've come so far in terms of technology. We understand quite a lot of like the molecular like pharmacology and what is occurring. And at the same time, we know so much about the human genome. And so I think that in neuroscience, you know, the next step would be trying to personalize, you know, various medications, repurpose medications to have personalized doses for individuals, because especially with neurological disorders, especially with Parkinson's as well as Alzheimer's disease, a lot of the patients are over the age of 65 that have these, you know, symptoms, and they're going to be on, you know, like at least 4 to 5 different medications at any one point. And I think, you know, it's really important to consider, you know, the interactions with these other medications that they're taking for other disorders, as well as trying to personalize a dose that is going to be very, very specific to the individual. I see that space growing immensely. I can see it like in here in Melbourne, as well as across the board. There are all these like at-home genetic test kits that are coming out to try and improve the personalization of just medicine as a whole, like healthcare, nutrition, you know, prescribed medicines. And I think that can really be applied to developing new drugs as well, because we have this data that we'll be able to use and screen for against these, you know, against these genomes, and really try identify what is actually causing, what is changing in these individuals to be able to I guess acquire these debilitating disorders. And I think the challenge, I guess, that still remains and is a major focus of like major clinical trials is that with any neurological disorder is you're trying to get in early before the neurons die. You need to get in there before the cells have died, because trying to save cells that are already dead is like Frankenstein stuff, right? Unless there is a major breakthrough in the stem cell kind of therapy area. So it's really trying to identify early like biomarkers for the disease and trying to intervene and come up with an intervention early on before they start, you know, showing, you know, these debilitating like symptoms, et cetera. So that space is growing immensely. You know, there are major projects that have already identified various biomarkers that will be able to detect whether you'll get Alzheimer's in 30 years time, but there is no treatment for that. So how do you test someone and tell them in 30 years time, you're likely, or you have a high chance of acquiring a disease where you're going to forget who your loved ones are, et cetera. So that's, you know, and there is nothing we can do about it right now unless you know, like, but I disagree. I think that you can make these choices in life early on. If you find out, you can make lifestyle choices, make healthier decisions based off, you know, what you know about, you know, a potential diagnosis down the track. So it's a ever-growing field, and neuroscience is never going to be fully kind of, you know, understood with the advancement of like AI as well. I think it's a major growing field, and you know, like I see news about you know, brain chips from Elon Musk's passion project, the Neuralink, trying to insert you know, various chips in our brains so that we can, you know, tap into the higher function of our brain's capacity. But I think it can really be applied to neurological diseases as well. I was really passionate about the research that was being done on deep brain stimulation for Parkinson's patients, because they have this tremor that is uncontrollable and it progressively gets worse. But this deep brain stimulation by inserting an electrode in the brain is able to, I guess, ameliorate these, you know, debilitating symptoms for these patients. So it's, again, it's a massive field. There is so much to be done, but at the same time, we're making so much progress with the advancement of technology, biotechnology. And I think now scientists are really kind of collaborating as a multidisciplinary kind of field, so that you're tapping into like engineers, bioinformaticians, you know, like genomics, as well as like pure molecular biologists and clinicians across the board. So it's a really interesting time to be in any sort of, I think, human biology science.
Yeah, it's absolutely mind-blowing, like, how much progress has been made. And to even just, like, try to think about where we'd be in, like, 5-10 years' time, it's just,
exactly,
it's crazy to think about, and how we're going to navigate that space.
Absolutely. I always use the analogy of, like for my generation, when I was young, we did have internet, but it was very limited. But if you think about how much internet has developed within that time, I mean, I didn't imagine we were going to have like phones where we could speak to our parents over FaceTime. Like, that's how old I am. But but here we are. I mean, you know, technology has advanced so much. And I think the next, I guess, I think the next evolution is not going to be the technological evolution. I think it's going to be a bio revolution. So I strongly believe that the space is about to,
yeah, it definitely seems like that's very likely. To bring this interview to a close, what's like one piece of advice you wish you'd been given at the beginning of your research career?
At the beginning of my research career, you know, I've spoken to various people, like towards my, or I think this year I've spoken to the most kind of like diverse range of people. I've attended like these symposiums where they're getting together CEOs of like biotech companies to assess whether, you know, what's happening next in the biotech field, not just biotech, but health tech, you know, healthcare as a whole. I wish that someone had told me at the very start of my research career, learn some more on the computational side of biology. I think it's a massive field, and it's a skill set that is going to be so valuable in years to come. I did the really fundamental, like hands-on, like biology, like, you know, doing like little neurosurgeries on, you know, the models that I use, and using cellular-based models. But I really envy those, those people that have the knowledge and the ability to apply a lot of like computational power into biology, because that's the future. I wish someone told me that. I wish there was more resources available for PhD students, or the time available for PhD students to, I guess, tap into these areas. But again, I think down the track, I will eventually like learn something like that, because I think what the main thing that I learned through my entire PhD, now I'm getting to like the final sprint, is that as a PhD student, you basically learn to become an expert in anything, given the time and the resources. We're given, 4 years, you're given the resources to be able to, create a project and then become like experts in that field. I think given the time and the resources, I could become an expert in any field if you set your mind to it. And I think that's really what a PhD is proving. You don't have to be, refined or confined to just your PhD project and then down the track going down that line. I think you can become an expert in anything, because that's what you've basically shown the science community, that you're able to become an expert. Work in progress.
Yeah, the computational biology definitely sounds worthwhile for anybody who wants to be part of like the future of neuroscience, to definitely look into. Yeah, so thank you for joining us today, Jay. It's been fascinating to hear. Like, love hearing about all like the future of neuroscience and what you're doing currently. It's just, thank you so much for joining us today.
No, my pleasure. Thank you very much for the invite.
DOSA Pharma acknowledges the traditional custodians of the various lands throughout Australia on which we connect today, and pays respect to elders past, present, and future.